Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight. Fiona Vent makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. She was here on the last time on the occasion of her her book on interviewing people, and on this occasion for a second book. I'll introduce her briefly. She's one of Australia's best-known interviewers, with a career in television spanning nearly 30 years. Fiona Vent was a 60 Minutes correspondent and has worked on a number of public affairs programs on television networks in Australia and overseas. And in 2005 to 2006, she wrote the Bulletin's magazine Lunch With column whilst presenting and reporting for Nine Network's Sunday program. As I mentioned, Fiona Vent is the author of A Matter of Principle, and she's moved from being a television identity to being a writer. And her latest book, Nice Work, Fiona Vent is going to talk to us about this book tonight. And the topic we've given her talk is Australians at Work. Fiona Vent, you're very welcome.
Well, Gerard, thank you very much for this invitation to speak here at the Institute, and to Anne, thank you very much. Look, I thought Gerard did allude to my earlier career as a television person, and in fact, to explain the genesis of Nice Work, I do need to reach back, albeit briefly, into my past work in television. Doing that job, I was at various times struck by just how strange an occupation it was. For instance, I recall travelling from Moscow to St. Petersburg on an overnight train during a white winter in the company of Russian nationalists who were running amok through the carriages, emptying bottle after bottle of vodka down their gullets. They were accompanying their eccentric leader, Boris Zhirinovsky, and I, for my sins, was with Zhirinovsky for the purposes of delivering a story on him. I can tell you it was a long night. A couple of days later, for that same report, I remember standing knee-deep in snow, delivering a piece to camera about the fall of communism for so long that my jaw seized up and I was no longer able to speak. And all this, the frozen jaw, that is, to produce 15 seconds of television. Similarly, as I trudged through the snow across a remote Canadian mountainside, I wondered whether the television ends would justify the means on this occasion. Somehow I doubted that we would ever discover the landing site of a UFO piloted by extraterrestrials, but nonetheless that was my job on the night. So surely, I said to myself at these times, there must be normal work out there in the world. There had to be jobs that were more regular than this, and I asked myself what other people did for a living. Now, ignorance is a terrible thing for someone who's made a living as a journalist to admit to, but it is in part a desire to fill in the gaps in my knowledge and experience that nudged me towards the subject of other people's working lives. The fact is that the amount of material that passes before, or if you like, through the average generalist journalist is immense. It may be that on Monday you're asked to investigate the dirty dealings of some used car salesman, so you do accumulate information and then some more information on top of that information until you're able to present a more or less coherent story about that particular dirty car dealer. When it's all over and the report has been published or broadcast, then a generalist reporter moves on. It's Wednesday, so it could be time for a story on tribal conflict in Yemen, or an overview of Australian literacy rates, or for an inside look at brothels. And in fact, the brothel is a convenient place to stop to consider the journalist's work. Because as a journalist, you are, of course, open to all comers, so to speak, and you are required to love the one you're with until you're paid to move on to someone else. So, if I could put it this way, with 3 decades of whoring behind me and with time to consider my sordid past, I thought of all the things I didn't know about the people I had interviewed. In the past, for instance, I would interview a CEO and I'd question him or her about a particular issue that was making waves at the time, and then I'd go home. But what was often missing for me was a context for what that person actually did day to day, aside from giving interviews, of course. The kind of work that I did on television often dictated that I drop into the professional, and I must say sometimes even the personal life of an individual, cherry-pick a newsworthy morsel from it, and retreat. But later I found myself asking, what did these people do when I wasn't around? When the excitement or even, God forbid, the trauma of media exposure died down, what was the actual job that they did? What were the fundamental requirements for it? How did their days start and finish? Just to pursue the CEO example a little longer, what made a person a good or, alternatively, an incompetent CEO? What did so-called dedication to the job mean, and how much of the flesh and blood person had to be given over to the job of CEO-ing? How much, if anything, could be withheld? Was it just a way to make a buck? Was it a contest in which you tried to trump or even bump off another actual or potential CEO? Was it a calling? So for nice work, I wanted to hang around as unobtrusively as possible to watch what actually went on in people's working days. I did want to look at the particular, the nuts and bolts of jobs, if you like. As it turned out, the project was more complicated than that, as it became obvious to me, even to me, that jobs didn't do themselves, people did them. So they brought with them their life history, their experience, and their attitudes, of course. And so each job template then was filled in, coloured in with individual colours by the particular worker. I didn't go in search of famous people. That wasn't my interest in this case. But as it turned out, a number of my workers were more widely known than just in their own work circles. Sometimes I have to say my task involved situations that did not exactly come naturally to me. For instance, as I stood in a life class observing the work of a sculptor, I found myself staring at the plump, bare bottom of a naked young woman. And as I did that, I felt strange. I was there to see how a master sculptor instructed his students, so of course I had no other job but to stand and stare. So there was I in the dust and the dead silence, watching students moulding tiny bits of clay into bottoms. And frankly, I felt like a Mormon in a bar, but that was my job, and I did it. Even more intimidating, I have to say, was sitting at the end of a boardroom table as the CEO of a large company, a cruise ship company, conducted a meeting with her senior executives. You can probably imagine the scene, a very impressive-looking boardroom, clocks on the walls designating the major centres for this particular big international business, Los Angeles, Miami, etc., etc. And as the executives were put through their paces, I found myself suddenly longing to be smaller, very, very much smaller, preferably tick-sized, so that I could avoid attracting attention to myself and run the risk of exposing my utter ignorance of business and commerce. I was desperately afraid of being asked about things like key performance indicators or revenue streams or something called allocational rigidities, all of which sounded like medical conditions to me. believe it or not, I find it hard to believe, that these are the kinds of topics that are chewed over at business seminars bearing titanic titles like Global Leadership Summit, etc. The tortured language irritated me, and since I can barely count, the figures eluded me. But I struggled on, and the struggle did turn out to be worth it in this case. During the time that I spent with this particular CEO, who you might have guessed was Anne Sherry of Carnival Australia, she was taken up with, to say the least, a very broad range of activities. She was engaged in a battle of wills, a kind of war with the New South Wales state government over port facilities, and she was personally waging a very carefully calibrated public relations campaign on that issue. At the same time, the CEO was travelling overseas for board meetings of the global parent company, where she had to compete for attention for her Australian division. She was also coordinating and presiding over extraordinarily elaborate publicity events on Carnival's cruise ships here in Australia. She was attending meetings of an unrelated board on which she sat, as well as mentoring an ambitious young woman who was having a hard time with another employer. And the CEO was also overseeing who would or would not get a pay rise. You'll recall, no doubt, that it was on board one of the company's ships that a woman had died in 2002 in awful circumstances. Diane Brimble had been found dead in a cabin on the Pacific Sky. Brimble had died 5 years before Anne Sherry was recruited to the CEO's job, but during my job, or now I'm even calling it my job, during my time at Carnival, not only was the company dealing with the trial of one of the men accused of involvement in Brimble's death, but also, that's been resolved, as you may know, in the last few days, or at least resolved up to a point, but also with the arrival of a fully-fledged health crisis on board the ships, that is, swine flu. All of these issues and more were being juggled at the same time by the CEO. And the CEO in question, Anne Sherry's trademark, is candour, and it was her openness that made the time spent with her so valuable. In order to write nice work, then, I did not just venture into working worlds where I felt comfortable. My experience with a boxer in training for a comeback was another case in point. I'd never much understood boxing, neither the reason for its existence nor the enthusiasm of its fans. But I admit I was curious about it, and I soon got into the swing of attending an inner-city boxing training gym. And I must say that when I mentioned to women in particular that I was doing this and that I was consorting with the so-called colourful characters at this gym, I get a response which was a facial expression that was somewhere between distaste and pity. I felt dirty for a while, but not too much, because it was actually a very interesting experience. When I first met Brett the Boxer, he was attempting to reduce a rather flabby 100-kilo body to the weight that his trainer said he had to make a decent showing in the ring. He needed to drop 20 kilos, in short. That sounded like a lot to me. Practically, for Brett the Boxer, it meant leaping out of bed in the wee small hours to pedal on an exercise bike before driving to a ditch in a suburban street to do his day job of repairing water pipes. It meant confining his diet to very sad drips of fruit juice, tiny, tiny morsels of fruit, and pale, pale thin bits of chicken, when his favourite foods were really pizza and ice cream, of which he normally consumed large buckets all on his own. And after a day of ripping monstrously heavy pipes out of the ground while standing and heaving in the mud and the muck, he'd go sparring in the gym. And he'd follow that with a session of running, and follow that with a session of weightlifting and muscle crunching, and the next day he'd get up and do it all again. On the first day that I met Brett, the first day that I saw him sparring in the gym, he tore a ligament in his left hand. This is not a good start to our relationship, because Brett is a southpaw, a left-hander, and the injury set him back for months, and in fact he thought I'd jinxed him. So this was a concern for a while in our relationship. But while Brett's hand was out of action, he and a few friends took me along to see a fight. and it turned out to be quite a night. At one point, I found myself standing in an open men's toilet cubicle at the back of Blacktown RSL, just so that I could fit into a room where a number of boxers were limbering up for their fights on the night. They were throwing punches into the practice mitts that their trainers were holding up, or some of them were shadow boxing. And as I propped in the toilet cubicle, I particularly noticed a huge man whose brown skin was oiled to perfection. He was, for reasons probably known only to himself, delivering blow after blow to one of those electric hand dryers you see on walls in public toilets. At the same time, the wizened old guy who was his trainer seemed to be passing on pretty basic instructions about ducking and weaving, which I thought strange at the time. I later learned that with just one professional fight to his name, Royce Seo was about to enter the ring with Solomon Hamono, a boxer whom the ring announcer called the excitement machine of boxing. Many of you may know, a former rugby league forward, Hamono had 16 professional fights to his name, 15 victories, 14 by knockout. Well, the bell rang, and these two huge men, mountains really, faced each other in the ring. And I looked down to make a note, as one does when one is researching a book, and when I looked up again, the excitement machine, 16 fights, 15 victories, 14 by knockout, was flat on his back. His eyes were fogged while hand dryer man was leaping excitedly around the ring. So this was boxing, I thought. Nice work. But just as I was launching into one of those meditations about the cruel twists of the game, I discovered that success had gone to CEO's head. He decided that while the excitement machine was down, he'd shoot another couple of big ones into his jaw. And since this was an outrageous breach, of course, of the never hit a man when he's down commandment of boxing and of life in general by now, the entire room stood up and roared as one with rage. Hand dryer man made a quick exit from the ring, and a posse of police followed him just in case the excitement machine's fans started to take matters into their own hands. There was much more that happened on that night. I'll leave that to you to explore if you ever get your hands on a copy of Nice Work. In the end, though, I thought that I had been lucky to be there, lucky to have a ringside seat. And as the promoter pointed out to me, when a shower of blood sprayed from the ring during another fight, lucky I wore black. The elephant in the ring is, of course, death, or at least the possibility of it. The boxer deals with it by saying that he prefers to do his business as quickly as possible, to get in, preferably knock out his opponents, and to go home, which sounds very sensible to me. One of my other workers, though, had to face death every day as part of her job. That is what forensic anthropologists do. Their specialty is osteology, that is skeletal anatomy and biology. In practice, that means examining the remains of human beings in a legal context, so providing information to police and the courts about the cause of a person's death. The working days of a forensic anthropologist can vary greatly, as I saw. One day I watched the forensic anthropologist, a young woman by the name of Soren Blau, who's based in Melbourne at the Victorian Institute of Medicine, a mother of two small children. She was giving evidence in the Supreme Court about a particularly grisly murder. The remains of a young man had been found in a drain, wrapped in a sleeping bag. Animals had begun to scavenge the body. She had been present during the opening of the sleeping bag, and she had examined the remains. In the courtroom, I saw a portly, grey-haired man sitting in the dock. The charge was that he'd been involved in torturing the victim before killing him. The forensic anthropologist was required to tell the court and the jury about what she'd seen, what the particular defects in the man's bones and the dead man's bones told her about the way that he had died. So that was one kind of working day for the forensic anthropologist. I saw quite another kind when I travelled with her to East Timor on her mission to solve what was effectively an 18-year-old mystery. She had assembled an international team of forensic anthropologists to excavate a site that many suspected could be a possible secret burial place of people who disappeared after a protest march in the East Timorese capital, Dili, on the 12th of March in 1991. Many of the young people who'd marched against Indonesian rule on the day had been shot in the grounds of a cemetery known as the Santa Cruz. I'm sure many of you are familiar with this. It's known as the Santa Cruz Massacre because a number of protesters disappeared, an unknown number of protesters disappeared. Despite commissions and inquiries, there were no bodies and no graves. So you can imagine what that meant for the families of these young people who'd been missing. The forensic scientists had made several attempts in the past to find the answers to this mystery without any success. This time they were digging on the strength of persistent stories and rumours about a particular site, a seaside town west of Dili. I have to tell you that the work very quickly paid off. On the second day of the excavation, I watched the brown earth and suddenly a honey-coloured skull emerged from it. It was an electric moment, certainly for me as an outsider, as a non-scientist and a non-professional in the field, but I saw also for the forensic scientist herself and her team. In the days that followed, I found myself staring into other graves containing human remains. Sometimes buried with them were belongings and clothing that were, ironically, perfectly preserved. For instance, the bold striped shorts of one skeleton are fixed in my memory, as are the high-top sneakers that the young man in the grave had put on the day that he died. Now, of course, they were attached to the end of smooth, fleshless leg bones. On some days, the forensic anthropologist would be lying stretched out full length in the graves next to the skeletons. They worked with fine brushes to clear away soil from the bones to make sure that the grave's contents were preserved in the best possible condition for the next stage of their investigations. At the end of the day, they'd leave the cemetery with large brown paper bags in their arms. They contained, of course, the bones that had been lifted from the ground. And sometimes the contents were too large for the bags, and the biggest bag, the biggest bones, the femurs, would poke out from the top of those bags. And it was strange to think that the scientists were carrying in their arms all that was left of a human being. The exhumations, of course, were only the first part of their work. There'd be many, many more working days for the forensic anthropologist involving the reconstruction of the body parts, interviewing relatives of the missing, taking blood samples from them in the hope, of course, of an eventual DNA match. Now, several months later, three of the first batch of DNA tests revealed that the remains were indeed the remains of, in the first instance, three young people, two 18-year-olds, one 22-year-old who'd marched to the Santa Cruz Cemetery 18 years before. This was a world first. The first time that any of the bodies of the missing from the Santa Cruz Massacre had been found and identified. And when the mother of one of the victims came to see what remained of her son on the mortuary table, she pointed to something odd that she saw in the skull. And it was the forensic anthropologist's task to explain to her that this was, in fact, the sign of a gunshot wound to the head. In effect, they had to tell the mother that their son had died a terrible death. But in these instances, and from seeing the responses and having conversations with some of the relatives and talking to other forensic anthropologists about their work, although it seems paradoxical, the sight of a skull in a situation such as that can be a gift because at last the parents know what happened to their children, and eventually, of course, they will have a grave to which they'll be able to go and to mourn and to pay their respects. So this was a forensic breakthrough, and by any standards of that particular job, a job well done. I did wonder, though, how anyone doing this work could assimilate it with a normal home life. How does it feel to go home at night with the day's work still on your mind? In this case, as I mentioned, the forensic anthropologist is a mother of two small children. And she does explain to me in the book, as best she can, how she manages to juggle, I suppose, what is in some ways, how she manages to manage a double life. She admits that after a few weeks away working in dusty graves in the way that I've described, she does find it hard to adjust to conversations about tuck shop duty back at home. And I think we can well and truly understand that. Now, I know that's all very grim, and so I don't want you to leave here this evening thinking that all of my working days were as grim as that. I had one day which was, in a manner of speaking, full of very enjoyable and torrid sex. I better rush to explain this. I enjoyed this courtesy of a person known as a Foley artist. And I don't know how many of you know what a Foley artist does, but a Foley artist goes to work every day to make the sound effects of humans and animals for feature films and television programs. And to do this, the Foley artist uses a vast array of everyday and, in fact, not so everyday objects and substances. The Foley studio is a cross between a warehouse and a junkyard, and the Foley artist's work requires banging and rubbing together and scraping and stroking objects to make authentic sounding sounds. And the reason why we need these sounds is that not all audio for feature films or television can be adequately recorded on location. So we do need these specialists, of which there are only, I gather, around 10 in Australia. It's actually, the job, by the way, is named after Jack Foley, who helped Universal Studios make the transition from silent films to talkies, and he famously jangled some keys into a microphone to make the sound of a slave's chains rattling in the legendary movie Spartacus. So, in my time with the Foley artist, I discovered that there was also a place for foodstuffs in the work. For instance, if you need, and I don't imagine this has occupied your minds too much in recent times, but if you do need to make the sound of a human spine snapping at any stage, and this is what the Foley artist I shadowed had to do for a science fiction film, all you require is a cabbage. Just one twist like so, I'm told, and you are there. So the sounds that you take for granted in a movie when you're watching, say, a period film where someone might be wearing a long gown and walking across a parquet floor, if you like, those sounds that you hear are created by a Foley artist. You might not be focusing on the sounds, but you'd sure know if they weren't there, and you'd sure know if they weren't right. So that is the work of the Foley artist. I should quickly jump to the sex, because I did headline it a moment ago. On one of my days with the Foley artist, she was working on an episode of the Underbelly series. It was a particularly racy one, a DVD version of the television program, and one of her tasks was to recreate the sounds of a drug baron having raunchy sex with his blonde floozy. And the solution was sorbeline cream. It's obvious. Helen had used it many times before, she told me, in many sticky situations, and she knew it was a lifesaver. And as the drug baron did his thing with his blonde, the Foley artist sat on a stool with her trouser legs rolled up, her sleeves rolled up, rubbing sorbeline cream up and down, up and down, up and down. You get the picture, and yes, it sounded just like the real thing. Needless to say, I now look at sorbeline cream with fresh eyes. In summary, and to get a little bit serious again, there was one factor that was common to all the workers that I spent time with. None of them could have imagined a life doing anything else. And this phenomenon of work defining or taking over the individual was probably best articulated, I think, by Anne Cherry, the CEO. I did ask her how much of her life was taken up with her job as CEO, and her answer, her first instinctive answer was 100%, because my brain is going all the time, she said. Ideas were constantly drifting into her mind, whether she was walking her dog along the beach or not, about her work. She later modified that a little bit to somewhere between 70 and 80%, but by her own reckoning, if I could put it this way, she was largely CEO for an option for with an option for totally CEO. A substantial part of Sherry was her job. It's also true to say that not one of the workers I met was anything other than deeply, deeply invested in his or her work, although two of them were profoundly disappointed at the end of their careers. Both of them felt unappreciated and undervalued. This was true in the case of a Catholic priest in his mid-50s, whose working life I entered just as he was being transferred after 12 years as parish priest of the largest parish in this city to one of the smallest. He saw this as a demotion, a disappointment, and he said to me candidly, "Let's face it, I've been dumped." The other was an elderly sculptor who felt that the value of his life's work had never been recognised by the art establishment. And the sense of disappointment in his case was compounded by the fact that he was very aware that his time was running out. He was 92 and frail, although he was still keeping to a working schedule at his sculpture school, as I mentioned earlier. He would still inspect students' work and offer advice, as well as doing what sculpting he was still able to manage. In his earlier years, Tom Bass, whom some of you may know, whose public sculptures are dotted around the country, had been a real firebrand whose fierce faith in his particular artistic ideal had had a deep, deep impact on many of his students. Our conversations were very interesting for a number of reasons. Firstly, because he had stuck so doggedly to his beliefs, and secondly, because he was still exceptionally articulate, and lastly, because of his willingness to talk about that big subject, in fact, probably the biggest subject of them all, of course, death. He did feel, as I mentioned, that his own was close. He thought about it every day, and he was preparing for it. I have to say I found myself not nearly as comfortable with the subject as he was. He had a strong religious faith, and he believed that when his frail body finally gave way, he was going to a better place. In fact, he told me that he felt at the time that he was almost irrelevant, was his word, to this age, because I live somewhere else. They're his words. And Tom Bass, as some of you might be aware, died just a few weeks ago, about a year after that conversation. So, I suppose it's pretty obvious from what I've said, that people's working lives have a habit of interweaving with their private ones. There were two marriage breakups among my workers in the time I was putting together this book. Both, it appeared, in some way connected to the nature of the work itself done by those individual workers. Writing the book, I was struck again by the willingness of workers to honestly open up their lives to me, to my prying eyes. And I thought that if we who do this kind of thing for a living, that is observing and writing, were to be honest, we'd have to say that it's a strange hunger that we satisfy by doing it. We are, I think, drawn to the lure of learning a secret, or if not quite a secret, then having privileged entree to the way that others live, of being able to see things in a light that few others can, and then interpreting that for anyone who may open a book like Nice Work. So that is my work, strange though it may be, and I have to say that just like the people that I wrote about, I just can't imagine doing anything else. So I thank you very much for your attention, Susan.
Many thanks to Iana Vint. Thanks also to Cause Chambers Westgarth for the use of this fine facility this evening. So we come to questions and discussion. Channel 648 on Foxtel and Austar is here tonight. So welcome to them, but means that when people are asking questions or making comments, we need to speak up a bit, otherwise I'll rephrase the questions from here. Great talk, interesting experience, but you mentioned a couple of your people, the priest and the sculptor, weren't entirely happy with their careers, but they'd all had interesting careers, and the other people you refer to and you write about have had pretty interesting careers as well. So to what extent was your work determined by that, or did you think of doing perhaps a chapter on the public servant or the latrine cleaner, or was that just too boring? Why did you pick the subjects that you picked?
Well, latrine cleaner actually is a good, solid idea, thank you, Jared. And, perhaps I should have focused on something like that. I'm quite serious, actually. Look, I had a number of interests. I was interested in a spiritual life, that is a professional spiritual life. What did it feel like to go to work every day in the service of God? That is why I suppose I ended up with a Catholic priest in this case, who I must say was a phenomenal, or still is a phenomenal individual, who shook some of the cliched perceptions that I had of Catholic priests. I must say I had a view, a kind of a Bing Crosby feeling about Catholic priests, you know, jolly and singing and humble. And that is not to say that Father Arthur Bridge, who was the subject for this particular chapter, is not a humble man, but he struggles with humility, and he admits to that, and he has a very he's an enormous character, both physically and in every other sense, and he has a very strong sense of wishing to be recognised by not only by the church, his employers, but also by the rest of us. And well, as I say, he shook some of my preconceptions, so that was one interest. And I'm also interested in a creative life. I did want to see what it meant to go to work every day to effectively create something beautiful, or to teach others to create something of beauty. And I was very attracted by the idea of someone who had spent fundamentally his entire life doing this work, and so Tom Bass seemed like a natural way to go. Some of the others, serendipity. I just became intrigued by what they did. Boxing, counterintuitive, never been, as I said, a great boxing fan. So I wanted to find out something that I knew nothing about before I ventured into this field. So a whole lot of different reasons.
I see you've been viewing Rocky Marciano videos.
Oh yes, the whole lot.
One of mine. Yeah, it's great. I'm very impressed. Now, before I call the next question, I should say that Robert Grundy's got copies of Jan Event's nice work over there. Right. So, Anne. Yeah.
The people you've taken are obviously devoted, found their niche, creative, as you say. Their work is sort of, it's not a hobby, but it's part of them, as you said with Anne Sherry. Do you learn anything about how they came to that spot? For those people for whom work is not like that, for whom work is what you have to do to pay the mortgage until you happily retire to do all the things that you really wanted to do, is there some sort of formula there, or is there a magic button that others can find?
Well, I mean, you're quite right, of course. I was very conscious when I spent time, and again, it was luck. I suppose that's what I call luck, that all of my workers were so deeply invested, including an acrobat, for instance, so deeply invested in what they did. But, of course, seeing that kind of fulfilment in the job made me think a great deal about people who don't have that choice. I mean, we obviously live in an affluent society where a lot of us think we have the right to determine what we do, and that we have the right to be happy doing it. And that a lot of young people these days have the five-year plan or whatever it is, and assume that if they want to be President of the United States, ultimately they will become President of the United States, which is tremendous that they are so optimistic. But it's a relatively, I think, modern phenomenon and an affluent phenomenon. There are lots of people who have to put bread on the table and will do anything to do that. So I was constantly conscious of that, because all these people were so fulfilled by their work. Even if they were unhappy about the conclusion of their working lives, they loved it, couldn't do anything else. It literally was them. So I think, you know, to my way of thinking, that's a great gift if that's the way that you can live, really.
Now, typically, how long did you spend with these people? Did it vary from person to person?
Yes, look, it did vary. I mean, some I spent months with. The boxer, for instance, was a matter of about eight or so months. Likewise, the CEO, many months. Forensic anthropologist, quite a few months. And so it was an interesting process of writing because the stories interwove. I would leave one and go off to, you know, I'd leave the forensic anthropologist and go and talk to my boxer and so on. So it, yeah, it all, they kind of all wove into one another. There are a couple of vignettes in the book, and one of them is the Foley artist, whom I mentioned, and another is a weather observer in Darwin, who, God love him, peers into the sky and, you know, looks into it the way a tailor assesses the quality of cloth, and talks to me about, you know, cumulonimbus, etc. And he does his work so that planes don't fall out of the sky, which I think is a magnificent job, all power to him. So there are a couple of vignettes, I suppose, because I spent a night, you know, his night session with him. But the others are longer term projects.
Do you think it takes real courage to go into the boxing ring?
Yes, you bet it does. You bet it does. Absolutely, yes. I mean, it's, you know, it's easy to be in a way contemptuous because, as I, you know, also
I'm
do.
Not contemptuous. No. I'm terrified.
Oh right, good. Okay. Well, some people, unlike you, can be contemptuous about the whole thing, and naturally, you know, it's a dangerous zone, as I go into in the chapter. Obviously, you know, it's dangerous in the sense there are plenty of crooks in boxing, shall we say, and have been in the past. But that's one aspect to it. But yes, it does take phenomenal courage to do it, and you know, in my time at the gym, not in the ring, I have to say, but closely observing, yes, I met lots of men, young men and older men, who did it for a whole variety of reasons, and I, you know, I found it compelling. But I must say, on Boxing Night that I referred to earlier, I did, you know, think about Norman Mailer, for instance, Norman Mailer's passion for it, and I did remember his quote that suggested that if you spent too much time enjoying the possibility of men beating them one another to insensibility, you might be playing with your soul. And yes, that did stay with me, that thought, as I enjoyed the night.
Look, yeah, the difference between a hobby and work is that someone pays you for work. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the role of money in terms of it being an incentive, a reward, and also a measure of your worth and success, and the role that money plays in work, especially for the people that you.
Well, look, again, look, if I could answer it sort of circuitously, for instance, the final chapter is about volunteers, and they are very particular volunteers that I was intrigued to go and spend time with. They are volunteers at the Jewish Holocaust Centre in Melbourne. And these are Holocaust survivors, and I mean survivors from Auschwitz and other camps, death camps, survivors of death marches and so on. And I really wanted to ask them and talk to them and observe why people who had lived through such a terrible time would then choose voluntarily, unpaid, to talk to others about that experience over and over and over again. I mean, the, I suppose, obvious answer is, and that is their answer, the initial answer is because they don't want it to happen again and because they need to tell young people about that experience. Nonetheless, the psychology of this, if you have lived through this, lost, as many of them had, you know, large numbers of their own family to this scourge, and then to be able to talk, and that's work, and that's unpaid work. So, you know, that's an interesting element. The other, look, the people I'm thinking of in the book, money, really not so much an issue. Again, for the sculptor, not so much an issue. If that's your passion, if it's the only thing you want to do, you can do in life, yes, you have to live, but ultimately, you know, the connection you have to this work will keep you there. That's what I found.
Have you thought of interviewing two or more people who are representing two schools of thoughts? Take, for instance, a couple of days ago, there was again a TV program on the Noah's Ark, and on one side, you know, some amateur, you know, insisted on this is Noah's Ark, and I got X, Y, and Z evidence. On the other side, there were scientists who said all rubbish and so on. Now, what would happen if you would interview these two opposing schools?
Well, look, it's an intriguing idea. You never know. I'll just put it into my memory bank and see what comes out the other end. It is an interesting idea, that kind of polemic, of course. It sounds like a very good television idea, I have to say. Point, counterpoint, nothing to do with me, but sounds like a very good idea. Yeah.
John.
Obviously, been exposed to a number of different cultures as well as our culture. Have you had a chance from doing the book to reflect on what constitutes an ideal life?
Oh, my goodness.
It's a question of what constitutes an ideal life.
Does it mean sort of, like you talk about volunteers, you know, like obviously those people might have been Sherry being absorbed in her work to the extent that she's spending 70% of the time walking the dog. Not engaging in anything other than the work. She's been in cultures where, you know, children are integral to the society, or old people are integral to their society. Have you reflected on who does it better?
Oh, well, thank you for the question, I think. Look, of course you do as you travel around and you look at how people live in the world, you do reflect on that. And you know, I guess no one culture has every answer to every question. I mean, I can only speak for myself, I suppose. And I can only feel happy if that's the benchmark of things. I can only feel happy if I feel as though I have a reasonably fulfilled home life and a reasonably fulfilled, if you like, creative life. There is a certain, if you know or if you have been unemployed, there is a kind of a dead zone for unemployed people. In fact, I was quite moved. I was talking to a group of people in Brisbane, I think it was, and someone piped up with a question from the audience and talked about the book and said, but of course the flip side to your book are those who can't work. And she was obviously a tremendously cultured individual who had some fine ideas about work and the rest, but you could see in her eyes that she was deeply sad and subdued by the fact that it was obvious that she herself was not working and could not work. And in fact, she came up to me afterwards and said with tears in her eyes, I'm the flip side to your book. And you know, there is a sadness in people if they can't exercise their talents, whatever they may be. So I think it's, you know, it's a collection of all those things, and ultimately it's a cocktail that's your individual cocktail for the way to live. I don't think I or anyone else can actually prescribe that and give, you know, a recipe for the best of all possible worlds, you know, to not coin a phrase, to use one.
Anthony.
Yeah, no, you started your remarks tonight about your work in television. I was wondering, the work for this book, did it make you reflect a little differently on your own work in the past?
Look, I have done a fair bit of reflection about my work in the past since I left television, which in fact is now, that was the end of 2006, so it's a while. I think, you know, in a way, I'll admit to being a bit of a strange fish in television, because while there were periods that I really loved and that were all that they appeared to be, you know, exciting and all of that, I never quite felt 100%, you know, to use the same percentage as I referred to earlier for the CEO, I never felt 100% part of that job. I always had what I thought was something in reserve, I suppose is the way I would put it. And so, you know, not working in television feels very natural to me, because what I'm doing now feels more natural to me than what I did before. So yes, I have reflected on it, and there were plenty of years of great experience and enjoyment, but I actually, at this stage certainly of my life, I wouldn't trade it for what I'm doing now. I think, you know, this kind of work allows for probably greater reflection, and if you're given to reflection, then, you know, that's what you do. I don't think television is a different medium, and it's a different working zone. You know, you either love it or you do something else.
Yes.
With your subjects, is there a commonality? Were they all driven? Did they all have this intense purpose? Or was there anyone who just did the job and went home?
In my bunch of workers, there was no one who just did the job and went home. There was a certain, there was an absolute application in most of their cases to do what they did. In a way, yes, they were. I think they measured to some extent their worth by how well they did their jobs. So, no, these were dedicated, every one of them, as it turned out, every one of them was a very dedicated, devoted worker.
Final question.
I remember teaching senior students through the 70s and early 80s, and work was seen to be a finite thing that was disappearing. We'd all, the world was going to become so technologically proficient we wouldn't have to work, and we had to educate young seniors for the world of leisure. But we seem to have gone back to work in a big way now, and even so with an ageing population where we talk about people not retiring. As you did all of this, did you see a new kind of emergence of the notion of work, or a new kind of vision among better educated, typically Western people, that work is actually something we hunger for, and in the right sort of capacity is going to keep us living longer?
Well, I can, in this case, the most obvious case to cite is, again, the sculptor in this case, where I watched him as frail as, I don't know if any of you knew Tom, but as frail as he was a man who was like, as I describe in the book, he was like a snowstorm, white hair, white clothing, deeply bent over a walking frame. And you would hear him in the studio in the morning as he'd come to review his students' work, and he would shuffle along the floor with great difficulty, but he certainly would not ever have considered not doing that. He could never have lived without that. And one occasion that I witnessed, he was working on a sculpture himself, which took great physical effort. And again, it was very quiet in the sculpture studio, and all his students were around him watching him working silently at this, and there was a sense that they were perhaps watching him doing this work for the very last time. And it was it was quite a moving moment. But as I saw him there, I thought, well, there is nothing else. There is nothing else. Of course, he'd worked to the end of his life, as it did transpire. That's what he did. And I'm sure he's not the only individual who has that sense of work being the ultimate proof of his own sense of values and the ultimate underlining of those values that he'd lived his life for.
Yeah, Ben, many thanks. Take a seat.
Thank you.
Well, I'll be very brief. As I said, there are copies of Nice Work over with Robert Grundy. Yana Ben said in her talk she was a strange fish in television. I think as a television interviewer that's probably true, because as I recall, as an interviewer, Yana Ben was more interested in the answers than in the questions, and that's not so common on some Australian television channels. Certainly not when you get up close to 7:30 at night. It's not so common. Yeah, so... But what we noticed tonight in Jan Event's book is very similar to what I noticed when Jan Event was in television, that she was interested in the answers. And so pursuing these people and their lives and their working lives, some have happy lives, all have busy lives, some have rather sad lives on reflection, but all have interesting lives and all are riveting lives as they're being portrayed by Jan Event. So I think it's great that Jan Event's moved to the written word, and she's had one book out, and now a second book, and no doubt there will be a third book and more books. But for tonight, many thanks for coming along and talking about Nice Work, and best of luck for Nice Work, and best of luck for your next piece of Nice Work. And well done for tonight. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.